Support for Aspen Public Radio comes from Balcom and Green PC, a full-service law firm with offices in Glenwood Springs, Aspen, and Basalt, providing advice and solutions for their clients' legal needs throughout Western Colorado for more than 60 years. Learn more at balcomgreen.com.
Live from Aspen Public Radio, it's Valley Roundup. I'm your host, Wyatt Orme. The Pan and Fork property in Basalt is back in the news as usual. The developer is out, the landowner is angry, and the town council is shaking its head. Also, Latino families in the Roaring Fork Valley are discovering public education isn't the only choice here. Also, Snowmass turns 50 this weekend. All that and more coming up on Valley Roundup. Joining me today is Cindy Hirschfeld. She's the editor-in-chief of Aspen Sojourner. Hello, Cindy.
Hi there.
And on the line, we have John Stroud. John, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Doing well, thanks. John is a reporter with the Glenwood Springs Post-Independent. Today, Cindy and John, you can just briefly relax. We're going to start with a conversation I had yesterday with Scott Condon. He's a reporter with the Aspen Times. He and I spoke about the Pan and Fork property in Basalt. This, if you'll remember, is the small parcel smack dab right in downtown. The Roaring Fork Community Development Corporation, or the CDC, owns the land. They and the developer, Low Enterprises, just decided to break a longstanding contract. Apparently, Low and the Basalt Town Council just could not see eye to eye on what kind of development the property should have. Scott Conan and I spoke about how some people want a park, other people want a development, but most fall somewhere in the middle. Here is our conversation. There seems like there's this group of people who want a park, and there's a group of people who want a development. But that's not really like a fair characterization, because it seems like the park people are fine with some development, and the development people also want a park. How do you like break this down when you think about this issue? Like, what are the different teams, and what do they want?
You know, I think there, with any issue, I think there are small core groups that are on either side of the issue. There's a small core that wants all park and no development.
Mm-hmm.
I think there is a small core group on the flip side that would like to see a substantial part of that property as development and thinks that there is enough park alongside the river. And so they see that as a great potential to extend Basalt's Main Street. Then I think you probably have more people that fall into the category of, yeah, some park and some development. And there's subsets within those groups.
Right.
Some that would prefer more park and a little bit of development. Some that would prefer more development, a little bit of park. And then to even make it more convoluted, we've got, remember there was the ballot question last year where there were a couple of ballot questions essentially, you know, do you want to pay to acquire this property?
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't spelled out exactly with a square footage, as I recall, how much development there would be. But, you know, that ballot question went down by a pretty narrow margin. But some people interpret that to mean, well, see, so people want development. And some people say, no, it just means that people didn't want to raise their taxes to acquire the park.
Hmm.
So it's reporters probably try to make it too black and white, but there is definitely a lot of gray in this one.
Fair enough. But I mean, nonetheless, you sort of have, you have this developer and the landowner breaking their contract. They're both extremely frustrated with the town. And, you know, you quote Michael McVoy, who's the board chair of the CDC, saying that there's a kind of an anti-development machine in Basalt.
I was thinking about his comment yesterday, and I mean, it's interesting. I mean, it's an interesting perspective. I don't know that I would characterize him as anti-development. I mean, we've got Willitstown Center, which is one of the largest projects in the Roaring Fork Valley, period. You know, over a half million square feet of commercial and residential property that's still being built now. Granted, it was built a long time ago, but the council has allowed some amendments to that. So you've got that going on. I mean, from his perspective, I can see why he says that about this particular piece of property. But, you know, it's an important piece of property, and I think some council members or all council members just really feel that they need to get it right. You know, and the interesting thing is, despite Michael's frustrations and despite the frustrations of Lowe Enterprises, the developer that had the option on the property, there's never been a formal application made for development on this property. The whole thing's been, with everything with this property, it just seems almost cursed. Nothing is easy with this property. And, you know, the developer wants some kind of assurance from the town that, in general, what they're proposing would be looked at favorably. Or it's in the ballpark. And the town's saying, you know, that's not the way it works. You gotta turn in an application and let us go from there.
I see that. I spoke with Jim DeFrancia about that, who's the developer. And I spoke with Jackie Whitsitt, the mayor. I see the point there that, like, if the town doesn't have an application in front of them, there's nothing for them to say yes or no to. At the same time, Jim DeFrancia said, I have gotten every indication in an informal setting that there's just no way that my idea is going to get approved. So why spend tens of thousands of dollars going through the process? When you say that, you know, the town council is really concerned with getting it right, there's this whole question of, like, minimizing the square footage in order to maximize the amount of space for a park and what can still be enticing to a developer. Through your reporting, have you found at all that, like, there are other developers who could be interested? I mean, is this just a lack of creativity, or does the council have unrealistic expectations?
Well, Jim DeFrancia is well regarded in Aspen, and he's been at the development business for a long time. So when he's talking about a 85,000 square foot condo hotel with associated commercial, which could be a restaurant and maybe a little bit of retail, I think he's probably looked at it and said that's what we need to make it work. So I don't think he's asking for anything unrealistic. The town council, you know, they have had so many discussions on this, but Gary Tenenbaum, when they were talking about Willits, Gary Tenenbaum's a councilman, and when they were talking about the Willits Town Center project on Tuesday night, he made the comment of, hey, look, we're here to flesh out compromises. To me, it doesn't seem like the two sides are all that far apart on the CDC property.
Yeah.
It's just a question of how do you finally, who's going to take the initiative to reach that final solution?
Right. And I mean, the final solution is, if the town is going to allow for such a small amount to be developed that no developer wants to touch it, then it seems that the other option is to buy the property. Is that right?
I think that's what some of the council members are saying, definitely.
Okay. Is that anti-democratic? And I can explain more. I guess I'm just asking, like, because the voters turned down, you know, in November of 2016, they turned down the prospect of buying the parcel. For the town to just go ahead and buy the parcel, is that kind of a dismissal of what voters already told them?
Yeah, that's a good point. And, you know, for each voter, it might be different. There's an interpretation of, well, they didn't want their property taxes increased to buy the park. Some would make a case, and I don't know if it's a valid case or not, that doesn't preclude them from using existing funds to acquire the property for a park.
Right.
So, yeah, there are definitely a lot of people that are saying you shouldn't be buying this property because voters turned down the proposal. There are others that would say, and some of them on the council saying, we didn't interpret that to mean that we couldn't use existing funds.
Right. It's kind of like, if they're going to be sued by the CDC, that's going to cost them. So, you know, they have to do something.
You're referring to CDC hired an attorney.
Yeah.
And that attorney wrote a letter to the town saying that his clients feel like they've been unfairly treated, that the town is taking too long, has kind of created an atmosphere where the developer that had an option on the property doesn't feel that he can go forward. So therefore, CDC has been put in a bad position where they can't recoup the money that they put into this. You know, what that letter doesn't say is the town hasn't taken any formal action on an application.
Right.
So what are they going to sue for?
And right.
That's what I still don't understand. I'm not sure that there could be litigation yet because there hasn't been an exhaustion of the administrative process. There hasn't been a vote by the council on a development application.
Fair enough. And that's because there hasn't been a development application submitted.
Well, I mean, let's look at it. Let's put it in terms of, you know, Aspen is going through a lengthy debate over the Gorsuch House, right? Mm-hmm. You've got Low Enterprises combining with partners to try to get that hotel built. And it wasn't looked at favorably in the form it was in by the Aspen Planning and Zoning Commission. So the application got altered. It's been before the Aspen City Council for several meetings. And now they're looking at it. They're trying to figure out what they can do with Lift 1A. We've had a lengthy process up there, and I don't really see, I see some parallels between those two projects. There's parallels in how they've kind of evolved, but the main difference is there's an actual application that, people are working off of, and that's what's been, always been missing in Basalt.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you raised the question of, is it undemocratic for the council to be pursuing a possible purchase of the property? Yeah, I can definitely see that point. I could see how that could be raised. But I think we've also kind of, we're lacking in the democratic process of people weighing in on a specific development application.
I see your point. I guess I just wonder, you know, as far as it being such a small community and there being a culture on the Basalt Town Council of being unfavorable to development, I just wonder if that's really at play. Like, maybe the administrative process hasn't been exhausted. Maybe you're right about that. Is it also a cultural issue?
You know, I don't know how a vote would go with the current council on Low Enterprises' latest application. You could probably say how five members would vote, but I think there's two wild cards, and I don't know if it would turn out 4-3 for approval of that, what DeFrancia has discussed, or I could also see it going down, I guess, 5-2.
Yeah.
You know, this issue's taken up so much time and it's created so much ill will that Basalt's just kind of stuck in this quagmire, and right now there's no apparent way out of it.
Yeah. And they're just kind of this good looking piece of property with a little black fence around it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, great. Well, Scott Condon, thank you so much for speaking with me.
All right. Thank you very much.
That was Aspen Times reporter Scott Condon on Basalt's Pan and Fork property. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back. This is Aspen Public Radio. You're listening to Valley Roundup, a look at this week's news with reporters and editors in the Valley. Putting things in perspective for us today are John Stroud with the Glenwood Springs Post-Independent and Cindy Hirschfeld, editor-in-chief of Aspen Sojourner magazine. I'm your host, Wyatt Orm. So the Pan and Fork development isn't the only development in the Valley that has hit somewhat of a dead end. Garfield County recently turned down a proposed change to a land use designation on some property near Carbondale. John, can you tell us any more about this?
This was before the Garfield County Planning Commission, and it was kind of a preliminary step before a development application was actually submitted. And it's the largest residential development proposal that the county has seen in some time. And it's interesting because it comes at a time when there's a lot more discussion around the issue of developing more workforce housing,
right?
Housing that can be affordable to the people that actually work here in the Roaring Fork Valley. And it was a large proposal, 400 homes on about 41 acres.
So really high density, right? I mean, we're thinking
really
this is
high density,
not like luxury homes.
Units were going to be in the range of about 800 to 1,500 square feet. And so, you know, not not big big homes.
Right. And the and it was turned down unanimously, right?
It was turned down unanimously by the Planning Commission to create what would have been called a residential village. And this is a provision within the county's comprehensive plan that allows for certain areas of the county outside of designated municipalities where, you know, higher density development might be appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the issue you always run into with these developments out in the rural areas is the effect on the rural character of those areas. And, you know, there's a lot of larger lot subdivisions in those areas, and people don't want to see large-scale, high-dense development next door.
Right, right. So, not entirely dissimilar from the Pan and Fork discussion. I want to pivot now to some reporting that you've been doing, John, on Latino enrollment going up in some of the Valley's private schools. You did a series on kind of the Latino community in public and private education. But can you talk to us a little bit about the Latino community enrolling more and more in either private or charter schools?
Yeah, that was one topic that I decided to focus on in this series. And first of all, this particular series of stories is part of a kind of an ongoing series that we've been working on, looking generally at the impact of the Valley's large immigrant population, and primarily those immigrants are from Latin American countries.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, a big impact is in the public schools, and the biggest impact is in the Down Valley school districts where, you know, most of the immigrant families live. And Roaring Fork Schools in particular, and that's the school district that serves Basalt, Carbondale, and Glenwood Springs. The Latino student population has grown to about 55% in recent years.
Wow.
And so, you've got a situation where the minority is actually the majority in the school
right.
district. And so it's kind of an interesting dynamic that you have here.
And one of the dynamics that you explore is having at least a comparable number of Latino teachers. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, with the increase in the number of Latino students, and particularly students who are learning English, the English language learners, as they're classified, there has been a push to hire more bilingual teachers and teachers who work specifically with those English language learners. And I found that in the Roaring Fork School District that out of about 850 regular full and part-time staff, about 126 of those identify as Hispanic or Latino. That's about 14, almost 15% of the school district's workforce. And, a lot of it is around language instruction, but it's also about having people in the schools and in the school district, who those students can relate to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so there's, there's been a real effort to try to have the teachers and other employees in the district reflect the overall demographic of the school district in terms of students.
So right.
That was one story that I decided to focus on. And
great. I wanted to ask you just about one element of that in our remaining time. And one thing you describe is the district giving out a seal of biliteracy for the high school students who can show that they're fluent in two languages at the end of the year. A lot of times I'm imagining that's English and Spanish. Can you talk to us a little bit more about that? Like, what's the benefit of a seal of biliteracy? I mean, it sort of would suggest that learning a second language is worth all the effort.
Yeah, and so this was something that a group of students got together with some district officials and principals to put together this seal of biliteracy, which is a basically a certificate that a high school senior can get upon graduation, showing that they have become bilingual in more than one language. Typically, that's going to be English and Spanish in
right.
Roaring Fork schools. And so it's just a way of acknowledging that effort and to kind of push kids to learn a second language, because that's going to benefit them in college and in their future careers as they go out and try to find jobs and compete on a global scale.
Fair enough. Well, great. Well, we are going to take a quick break, and we'll be back in just one moment. You're listening to Valley Roundup on Aspen Public Radio. I'm Wyatt Orm. Giving us the backstory today are John Stroud, reporter with the Post-Independent, and Cindy Hirschfeld. She's the editor-in-chief of Aspen Sojourner Magazine. And earlier we heard from Scott Condon, a reporter with the Aspen Times. I'm your host, Wyatt Orm. Okay, Cindy, so Snowmass is turning 50 this weekend. What can people expect? What's going on?
I was over there a little bit earlier today, not skiing, just meeting a friend for lunch, but there are a lot of people over there. It had, I'd say, a spring break type of vibe.
Okay.
People out skiing today. Fun. Weather certainly has a little bit to do with it. A lot of people out on the patio at Venga Venga, elsewhere on the mall, listening to DJs play music, having some drinks. Today is the notorious $6.50 lift ticket day.
Wow.
And tonight is a party that's sold out atop Elk Camp Gondola, retro party. With drinks themed throughout the decades and costumes. And tomorrow is Banana Days.
Okay.
Which it was a pretty popular event from the 80s and 90s, I guess up until 2002, that I don't remember it from my early years here, but they are hiding 1,967 plastic bananas around the slopes and the Mace Village and the Snowmass Mall.
Presuming that they all get found?
Yeah, I wonder how they're going to keep track of that.
But
each banana has a prize in it, some kind of certificate.
Okay, so there's an incentive.
There is an incentive. Some of the, I think the grand prize is a trip to a Caribbean island for two.
Ooh, wow.
Yeah, okay. And then tomorrow night is another sold-out event, a big gala at the Viceroy. And then on Sunday, they are doing a community picnic, which I believe is now at the Uhlerhof. Mm-hmm. It got moved down a little lower on the mountain, and they're recreating something called the Cabin Jump, which was in the 70s.
Which probably sounds exactly what it sounds like, right?
It is, although I think as opposed to a real cabin, they're doing some kind of modified structure,
okay,
cabin-like, and,
okay,
and a rail jam. But
very nice.
Yeah, it's definitely buzzing over there.
Okay.
It's fun.
So at the beginning of this issue of The Sojourner, you write that Snowmass is, you insinuate in your remarks that Snowmass is kind of looked over maybe compared to the other mountains. I just wonder why you think that's it. Why you think that is?
Well, we're so spoiled, right? That so many people I know in town literally will not go past the roundabout to ski. They just do laps on Aspen Mountain all day. Snowmass is just that much further. If we were in any other ski town and just had Snowmass, it would be a fantastic draw in and of its own right. I love the mountain because there's so many nooks and crannies. I think on a powder day, there is just nothing like skiing the Hanging Valley Wall. And what amazes me is I've been skiing it now. This will be my 20th winter or 21st winter skiing it. And I will go in places on the wall. I swear I've never taken the same place down twice. There are just so many different ways to go there. So
yeah,
that variety of terrain and the fact that people spread out so much, it doesn't get super crowded, even
right,
though it's, you know, the biggest and draws the most visitors, outside visitors of any of our ski areas.
Okay, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it has a lot to offer.
Yeah. Right?
It's definitely worth the bus ride.
So this issue of the magazine celebrates the history of Snowmass.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything that you learned? Is there anything that surprised you in learning about the mountain? Anything that was kind of unexpected?
So one of our writers, Catherine Lutz, put together this feature on history of snowmass in a lot of different ways. And one of the things she starts out with, I love the story of talking to the original marketing manager for snowmass. His name is John Cooley. And he told her an anecdote about attracting Stein Erickson to be the first director of the ski school out at snowmass, figuring a big name like that at the time would be, you know, a really big draw for this.
Can you just remind listeners who that is?
So Stein Erickson was a very famous skier from Norway who was an Olympian, and he had this distinctive style of skiing that if you see a picture, you instantly recognize him with his shoulders angled and his blonde hair flowing and his Norwegian sweater. And he was just, you know, God's gift to skiing at that time. And he was in a contract at Sugarbush in Vermont, and so he and John Cooley had a handshake agreement about Erickson coming here. Then the owner of Sugarbush wouldn't let Erickson out of his contract. I think John Cooley suggested, well, go in and talk to him and bring your wife this time. And they did, and Erickson's wife, I guess, broke down in tears about them not being able to leave Sugarbush, and the owner said, okay, you can go, and released him. And so he came here, and he also recruited a lot of ski instructors from Norway, some of whom are still on staff at Snowmass today.
Wow, that has sort of like a Hollywood cinematic element to it.
Yeah, I just didn't know that little bit. But there are lots of fascinating little stories. If you look in the issue, we talk about some of the people who are trails are named after. We talk about some of the businesses that have been there since the beginning. There's a lot of characters in Snowmass.
To be for people who are visiting or people even who live in the valley, does Snowmass have anything coming up in kind of the next few years that you think is noteworthy? Like, what can we expect from Snowmass in the coming years?
What everybody is really excited about is the restart of Base Village, which was started at least 10 years ago. You know, it has been dormant with holes in the ground, just a few things built. But now construction has started in earnest after partnership between KSL, Aspen Ski Co., and East West closed last December, mm-hmm. so about a year ago. And for fall of 2018, there will be a new Limelight Hotel, the third of that brand that Ski Co. owns. There will be a new condo building. They're going to have a new central plaza in Base Village that will have an ice rink in the winter and kind of a gathering place. And then there's this building TBD that will be built, and they're still trying to decide what it's going to be. It was originally proposed as the Discovery Center to showcase some of the Ice Age findings, but that ultimately hasn't been approved, so they're trying to figure out what the town wants it to be.
Okay.
So that's going to bring some new energy. There are a couple of new restaurants open now for this season, and I think a lot of people are going to discover Snowmass this year with the 50th and season-long events going on around it.
Well, great. Well, you heard it here first.
Snowmass fan, me.
Well, I think that's probably going to do it for this week's Valley Roundup. Thanks so much to John Straub, reporter with the Post-Independent. John, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, my pleasure to be here.
Cindy Hirschfeld, editor-in-chief of Aspen Sojourner Magazine. Cindy, thanks.
Thank you so much.
And Scott Condon, our conversation was recorded yesterday. Scott Condon, reporter with the Aspen Times. I'm Wyatt Orm, your host this week. I'm also a reporter here at Aspen Public Radio. Head to our website for more information on the stories we covered in this show, aspenpublicradio.org. Thanks so much for listening. Valley Roundup is a production of Aspen Public Radio News.